Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, Chairperson. Thank you very much to the organizers for this invitation to present at this forum. I must admit, when I looked at this this topic, what is the benefit of AF ablation beyond complete AF elimination, I was taken aback. It's a rather intuitive topic, and certainly can be viewed as a tough sell. It's almost as if I'm trying to sell ice to Eskimos, given that we have a group of proceduralists in the audience, including myself. This is my disclosure. We are all familiar with the adage that atrial fibrillation begets atrial fibrillation. And of course, that means the resultant comorbidities of stroke and mortality, including heart failure. Therefore, the corollary must be true, namely, sinus rhythm begets sinus rhythm. And then we assume that this would be resultant in a reduction in the overall complications. But as in all things, this should undergo a litmus test of randomized control trials before we can prove that. What we do know is that AF ablation improves symptoms, and that's the class one indication. But up until recent trials, there was no evidence that AF ablation lowered the risk of stroke or death. Pulmonary vein isolation is not completely innocuous, as we know, given the spectrum of recognized complications, most severe of which being atrioesophageal fistula, which is about 0.9% in non-contact force catheters, and that can go up to 5.6% using contact force catheters. The benefit of ablation in the asymptomatic patient, however, remains questionable. We need to reconsider the standpoint, however, given the current technologies and current AF ablation techniques. And this slide shows previous data representing ablation against drug management of atrial fibrillation. And as we can see, ablation fared better in terms of recurrent AF reduction across the spectrum. However, these studies had a limited representation of patients with significant cardiac morbidities, and the groups were largely paroxysmal AFib, and it excluded older patients. And patients were followed for a relatively brief period of about 12 months, and the studies were not powered to reveal the possible beneficial effects of ablation on mortality, stroke, and bleeding. But is there any relevance in pursuing sinus rhythm? As we have data from several trials regarding antiarrhythmic drug use, suggesting that there was little advantage of rate control over rhythm control, the largest of which being the AFFIRM and the RACE trials. However, we know that arrhythmia drug therapy is also accompanied by significant side effects and potentially has a pro-arrhythmic potential. There have been a number of preceding trials alluding to an improvement in overall symptoms, as well as objective improvements in LV function, quality of life, exercise capacity after ablation for AFib. And I've listed those. And again, we're faced with the same problem, that these were not powered to show a reduction in mortality or heart failure, and therefore did not reach these conclusions, and they also had a smaller number of patients. We now have the first randomized controlled trials that are powered to investigate the effect of catheter ablation on AF versus conventional first-line antiarrhythmic drug therapy. And we looked at the hard points of mortality and disabling stroke prevention. And this entailed the Cabana trial from Doug Packer's group and the Castle AF trial, from Marush and colleagues. So looking at the Cabana trial, the primary endpoint was a reduction in all-cause mortality, disabling stroke, serious bleeding, and cardiac arrest. And the major secondary endpoint was that of reduction in cardiovascular hospitalization. So the trial looked to enroll patients with new onset or undertreated paroxysmal, persistent, or longstanding atrial fibrillation who warranted therapy. And the key inclusion criteria were patients older than 65 years of age, or if they were younger, they had greater than one risk factor or a previous history of a CVA. They were eligible for ablation and or had two or more rhythm or rate control drugs already. Patients were randomized in a one-to-one fashion to the ablation arm and to the drug therapy arm. Just over 1,000 patients were enrolled into the ablation arm, and the ablation entailed a standard pulmonary vein isolation or wide area circumferential ablation, ancillary ablation, namely linear lesions or CAFE ablation, was left up to the individual center or proceduralist. Anticoagulation was also dependent on the operator's choice. Drug therapy was also left to the individual center and was aimed at either rate control or rhythm control, and anticoagulation was also left to the individual center. So a total number of 2,204 patients were enrolled into the trial. Just over 1,000, as I mentioned, were in the ablation arm, and a similar number were enrolled in the drug therapy arm. It's interesting to note that about 9.2% of patients in the ablation arm actually crossed over to the drug therapy arm, and a larger number, 27.5%, crossed over into the ablation arm. And this may have been the factor that affected the final results of this trial. Patients completed average follow-up of 48 months in both groups. Patients in both groups had significant comorbidities, and I've listed them there, drawing attention to about 9% of patients having cardiomyopathy in the ablation group and about 11.2% in the drug therapy group. Those presenting with congestive heart failure were about 15% of each population, and most of these patients were NYHA grade 3 to grade 2 to 3. Patients had a spectrum of AF, namely paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, and a significant number of patients were persistent atrial fibrillation. And patients were followed for a median of 1.1 years. And it's the severity of atrial fibrillation is listed with most patients in class 3 to 4 AF. So the trial resembled much of the preceding data in that there was a 47% reduction in recurrence of AFib with ablation compared to drug therapy, with a statistically significant result. However, looking at the hard endpoints in terms of the event rates of mortality and stroke reduction as well as bleeding, this did not show superiority of ablation over drug therapy and therefore was regarded as a negative trial. However, we can see that there's a trend to a better outcome with ablation further out with follow-up. However, this may be offset by the adverse events in the trial. Looking at the ablation arm, there was a significant incidence of complications, primarily due to catheter insertion and manipulation within the heart. But in the antiarrhythmic drug population, the side effects, namely, were related to the use of amiodarone, and relatively low incidence of 1.8%. The COSL-AF trial was a multi-center trial, open-labeled RCT, assessing whether catheter ablation lowers morbidity and mortality as compared with medical therapy, either rate or rhythm control. And patients had underlying LV dysfunction and were medically treated. So just summarizing the inclusion criteria, patients either had paroxysmal or persistent atrial fibrillation or longstanding persistent atrial fibrillation and had medically treated heart failure grade 2 or higher. Patients all had an ejection fraction under 35%. And patients, in addition, were implanted with an ICD. So this is the baseline demographics of the patients. And we see that there is a significant proportion of patients with symptoms of heart failure in mainly NYHA grade 2 or grade 3. In terms of the etiology of LV dysfunction, there was a distribution that was predominantly non-ischemic. However, there was a significant ischemic population in the medical treatment arm. And a fair number of patients were actually persistent rather than paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, which is characteristics of preceding studies. The left atrial diameter in the ablation arm had a median of 48 millimeters, while the left atrial diameter in the medical treatment arm was 49.5 millimeters at median diameter. Looking at the patients that had ICDs, the predominance was an implantation of dual chamber ICDs, although a significant proportion, also about a third of patients, had CRTD implantation in both arms. And those patients having a single chamber ICD had a floating atrial sensing dipole, which allowed adequate interrogation of atrial arrhythmias. The ICDs were primarily implanted for a primary prevention reason, although there was about a 10% or 11% secondary indication. So these are the results of the COSL-AF. There were 24 deaths in the ablation group and 46 deaths in the medical treatment group, which was 13.4% and 25% respectively, giving a significant reduction. There were 37 patients with heart failure related admissions in the ablation group and 66 patients in the medical therapy group, again showing a significant reduction. Another feature of this was that the complication rate in the trial was fairly low. There were three patients in the ablation group that had a pericardial effusion, one requiring a pericardiocentesis, and three patients that had severe bleeding, one patient with asymptomatic pulmonary vein stenosis. And one of the major criticisms is that if we look at the number of patients initially assessed for the trial, these were over 3,000, but almost 2,615 patients were excluded. Eventually, only 200 were assigned to the ablation group and 197 assigned to the medical therapy group. So eventually, with loss to follow-up, 179 were in the primary analysis in the ablation group and 184 in the medical therapy group. So the main limitations were that eventually, the attrition rate in both arms was fairly high, with only a small number of patients included in the final analysis. Also, it took about 8 years to select 363 patients from the 3,000 patients, with mortality benefit only emerging after 3 years into the trial. In addition, the authors mentioned that the patients had ICDs or CRT defibrillators implanted, and this may have affected the overall mortality in each group. So returning to the question, is there benefit of AF ablation beyond complete AF elimination? So catheter ablation for patients with paroxysmal or persistent atrial fibrillation has been shown to be superior to drug therapy for rhythm control. And now we have evidence that catheter ablation in the face of heart failure also has a lower incidence of recurrence of atrial fibrillation and also benefits patients in terms of all-cause mortality reduction, hospitalization for cardiovascular risks, and disabling strokes. However, this needs to be taken with a pinch of salt. However, the data suggests that patients undergoing ablation with underlying LV dysfunction and heart failure should be selectively chosen. Thank you.
Well, I think there was a little misunderstanding of the topic, but never mind. You gave the talk of Philip Sommer, in a sense. Oh. My actual question when we made this title was a little different, and maybe we discuss it now a little more. We usually say it's 30 seconds is a recurrence if you get 30 seconds AF. But in clinical practice, in everyday life, it's different. You find people who have only 1% AF load. Is this, in the clinical sense, a failure to your view, or is it not?
So patients with 30 seconds of atrial fibrillation, post-AF ablation?
Yeah, that's right. It's usually, in a comparative sense, it is a failure. But my feeling nowadays is that we should rethink this endpoint, because you find that patients with an atrial fibrillation load of less than 1% are clinically well, and patients have hemodynamic benefit if they remain below 5% atrial fibrillation burden. So, Joseph, what's your view on that?
This issue was discussed last year, or 2 years ago already, during this task force on AF ablation. And most of us agreed that this is nonsense. 30 seconds, why not 35? Why not 40 seconds? And that's why in task force there's already clinically effective ablation or clinical efficacy, more than 75%, or if you have a reduction of burden, more than 75%, so that you can call it clinically effective. And we have, in my center, we did retrospective analysis of about 3,000 patients, and those patients who had clinically a good control of the rhythm, which doesn't mean that they may not have even one cardioversion over time, but clinically they feel well many years without AF or maybe some few episodes of short bursts of AF. They did much better than those patients who had AF or a lot of episodes of AF in terms of mortality. So we have mortality data from a registry of citizens, and those patients did tremendously well if they had clinically relevant reduction of AF, which does not mean that they may not have 30 seconds. So I agree that if you are studying two technologies or two approaches, you have to use some scientific, data to measure exactly every recurrence, but clinically I believe that if you achieve significant reduction of AF burden, it will pay off in terms of better quality of life, but also maybe better prognosis.
And patients post-AF ablation, what we do know is that they have a higher incidence of asymptomatic atrial fibrillation. So
very short.
symptom-wise, we do impact that.
Well, we still don't know what does it mean if they have asymptomatic episodes. If they have a risk of stroke, they will be on anticoagulation anyway. So I don't know if they had some asymptomatic episodes. I'm just telling what I know. And I believe also in Cabana, if you really take per protocol how patients were treated, there is significant improvement. And obviously 40%, almost 40% of patients was treated differently than originally assigned. So that's a big overlap or crossover, let's say. So
I think
if you don't perform ablation, it's not like if you take one drug and or the other drug, but if you perform ablation or not perform ablation, that's significantly different in this
patient. I agree
patients.
With you, totally. You have 40% really not assigned to the treatment arm. I mean, you cannot do an intention to treat analysis in that kind of trial.
Yeah, but if you look at the per protocol data, it confirms what I said, that those patients who had ablation, they are better and they have better prognosis.
I think it's quite visible, especially if you treat heart failure patients. So we were actually in the Casilev trial and enrolled around 40 patients. It was clearly visible if you were able to reducing atrial fibrillation burden. There's a clear benefit on heart failure patients, reducing hospitalization and improving quality of life. Of course, at the end, cause mortality benefit. So if we select special patient population, in which is clearly visible, we can see. Of course, there's no effect on stroke prevention if you have atrial fibrillation, but the burden is quite important for some symptomatic, especially in heart failure.
Okay, there are no more comments. I think we move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.